The 100-year-old Dozier School for Boys closed in 2011. Former students revealed abuse, torture, and murder at the school over the decades. This is Florida Matters.
Support for Florida Matters comes from the Hospitals of BayCare Health System, providing more than 100 health seminars, classes, and events each month. BayCare's mission is to build a healthier Tampa Bay. Register for a complimentary health seminar, class, or event at baycareevents.org.
From the Donna Studio at WUSF Public Media, I'm Kirsten Cooper. The Tampa Bay History Center recently hosted a panel discussion on the Dozier School for Boys, known for decades of abuse, torture, and even murder. The discussion featured some key players in the investigation of the now-closed Dozier School in the Florida Panhandle. The panel includes USF forensic anthropologist Aaron Kimmerly, Tampa Bay Times reporter Ben Montgomery, and victim activist Glenn Varnado, whose uncle's remains were among those found buried at the school. On today's show, we're bringing you highlights of that discussion, moderated by Tampa attorney and History Center trustee Bob Boltz.
If you were a boy growing up in Florida, you could not help but fear the implications of the word Mariana. Mariana. You could be growing up in Central Florida or Jacksonville, and you knew about Mariana. It was a place that was very scary. It was far away, and you didn't want to go there. If a mother wanted to discipline her boy, all she had to do was say, I'm sending you to reform school. And everybody knew what that meant. And you just didn't want to run the risk. So, and if you were so unfortunate to end up in Mariana, and if you were to act out, or God forbid, try to run away, you would be brutally punished. And you're going to hear some more about that tonight. But there was a smaller group of boys that went to Mariana that, if you can believe it, they were even less fortunate than the White House boys who were brutally beaten. These were boys who died at the school. They were taken from their parents and families, frequently abruptly, transported to Mariana, and they never came home. So if you've got children, just pause for a moment and try to visualize what that might mean to you as parents. They just disappeared. And they were buried in unmarked graves. And some died under very suspicious and potentially criminal circumstances. They were unaccounted for in the state of Florida. And I hate to say this, purposely forgotten. And occasionally, at times, their existence was denied by the state. That is to say, they were forgotten until a young anthropology professor from University of South Florida, Dr. Aaron Kimmerly, decided to do something about it. Her professional interest in this subject was piqued when she noticed, quite conspicuously, an absence of records generated by this legendary school. So Aaron decided to try to find out what happened to these boys. And if she could, she was going to find them, identify them, and bring their remains home to their parents. And it gives me a great deal of honor and pleasure to introduce you to Dr. Aaron Kimmerly.
Thank you, Bob, for inviting us and setting this up and for everything that you did through this process. There was one year in particular where we tried to get permission to do excavation, and we thought it was simple because normally our work is a little bit simpler, and it was anything but simple, and you were a huge part of that, and we're very, very grateful. And it was really an honor to do this work and to work with Ben and Glenn, who I've told my students and many people since, I think I'm most grateful for these last few years and just getting to know these folks and the other families and the relationships that have resulted. It's really very personal for me in that way. So to briefly kind of take you through what we did and what it means to us, I, like probably most of you, first heard about this when I read Ben's stories and had the opportunity to meet Ben and Robert Straley, who is one of the founders of the White House Boys. And like many people, my first reaction was probably, really? This really happened? And how does this happen? And I haven't heard of this. But I was very moved with what I read specifically about Glenn and his family, and also a woman named Ovelle Krell. Glenn's uncle, Richard, had been looking for his brother. Ovelle also had a brother that was missing, and they're quite elderly, and they reminded me a lot of the grandmothers and grandfathers that I had met doing work in Bosnia and in Peru, where often the survivors are the grandparents, and they have to search for their missing loved ones. I called a friend of mine who is an archaeologist in Florida, and he did historic cemetery preservation, and asked him, Rich Esterbrook, if there's this burial ground on state property, there are laws that protect it and that give families the right to have access. So why wouldn't we document it like we do all other historic cemeteries? And that's really what started our work in the project. At the time, there was 31 white crosses in this burial ground, and there was really a list, basically, that the state had put together of who should be buried there, but the markers didn't correspond to graves, and no one knew exactly if that list was exact. My colleague at the Times experience is that rarely are cemetery records correct, even modern day ones, so there probably was more to it. But knowing that there were these families who were looking for answers, looking for access, we just hoped that maybe we could provide more information, get it registered. At the time, it wasn't even registered as a cemetery. And so our thoughts were really towards preservation and making sure that families had access. We found that most of the burials, the boys were buried in handmade coffins, probably made at the school. Some of them were manufactured. They might have come from the state hospital, which actually had a casket factory and not only made their own burial containers, but made enough to sell in the area. In that area where the white crosses were, there were in fact 13 burials. Some of them were under trees. You may have seen some of the pictures with big mulberry trees. And it was interesting because it was quite a task just to get to cut down trees. Can't cut down trees on state property, even if they're on burials. So we had some help from Jeff Atwater's office on that. What happened after we excavate is everything's brought back to USF, and very carefully the skeletal remains, the human remains, are analyzed for age, ancestry, stature, health, whether or not there was trauma. The preservation was not good enough to say anything specifically about injuries or cause of death. We were able to send off samples for DNA and start to get matches, but we had the families who had already been public and then had to work really with public outreach and public engagement to try and get more families to come forward. We used genealogists. Sheriff G gave us a cold case detective who has access to lots of databases that the rest of us don't have. And we were able to find a lot of families. And we found that with each press conference or each time we made public statements, then families would actually get in touch with us as well. And that was great for getting their samples. Glenn's uncle, Thomas, was the second identification that we made. We were so excited. Interestingly, Ovelle, the other family who had been public, was the first. And turned out it was the first burial we actually excavated. So it was amazing. And we subsequently have made 7 positive identifications through DNA analysis. 4 of them have been returned to families, and the families have had reburial ceremonies. 3 of them are pending, just pending some paperwork, and will be returned to their families very soon. And then we have 14 boys that are what we call presumptive ID, and what it means is that we think we know who they are, based on their age and their ancestry and the date when they died and their relationship to others who died, because in some years there were multiple deaths and they kind of were buried in a row. So we feel confident in those 14, but because we don't have a DNA sample, I can't say it's 100% them. So one of the questions going forward is that presumptive ID enough that we can say this is who we believe it is and actually give those remains back to their families? And I know that's what they want, so hopefully we'll be able to do that. And then for all of those who we haven't identified, the big question for the state is, what will they do? How will they identify them? Where will they bury them? How will it be remembered? How will the whole history and what's happened be remembered? And what's the best way to do that? That burial ground today, it's pretty overgrown. You can see why it was overgrown so much over the past 100 years. It grows quickly. And right now, nobody's maintaining the space, the site. And so whether they'll actually come to USF, get these remains, and bring them back, there is yet to be seen. I think there is a strong feeling among a lot of people that that will happen, but we have yet to see.
Ben Montgomery. Ben was a seasoned Enterprise reporter with the Tampa Bay Times who picked up on the story of Aaron's quest, and he pounded away on it eloquently, passionately, relentlessly, until the broader media got wind of it. Eventually, virtually every print and television media source in this state was reporting the Dozier story. And eventually it spread throughout the entire country and internationally. And presently, there's even a documentary film, at least one that I'm aware of, being made. So it was Ben and his editors and his staff at the Tampa Bay Times who generated the critical mass of publicity that allowed this whole momentum to go forward. And as you know, that was a huge influence on the politics of the whole situation. And as Aaron alluded, in time, the politics very slowly started turning. For his series on the Dozier School, Ben has been awarded several journalism awards. And in 2010, he was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in local reporting. Please welcome Ben Montgomery. Thank you.
We had this giant question. So the abuse happened. 500 men are saying it. The record says it. Every journalist who shows up found it. The next question became, and we got the school closed down. 2011, June of 2011, the state decided finally after 111 years to close Dozier and send the kids who were incarcerated there to another place. That was controversial in Jackson County. They need jobs. It's a place that values that kind of work. Many, many people in Jackson County work in corrections, several other prisons, juvenile facilities there. But one question remained for us, and that was, who's buried in this cemetery? There's 31 pipe crosses. The FDLE opened an investigation, thanks to Charlie Crist. They closed their investigation saying, hey, we used all the records that the guards kept at the school, and it looks like there are 31 boys buried there, and we don't, in small print in the very back of the report, we don't know where these other 81 boys are buried, but there are 31 there. And it was a cursory, rudimentary investigation. And we just kept sounding the bell about that. Like, what, how is this okay that the lead law enforcement agency in the state of Florida can do such a shabby job of, like, they didn't even use ground penetrating radar. I sent an email to my boss after that report came out, and we had written a couple of stories criticizing the FDLE. I wrote a note to my boss. It was like, things we should do. And it had a couple of story ideas on there. And then one of the things at the bottom, she sent me this the other day, was, is there some way we could rent some piece of machinery that would allow us to take a picture in the earth? As if you could like pick something like that up at Home Depot, you know? So, but I'm trying to say this was beyond my skill set to do anything besides just ask questions over and over again and criticize the state agency. And long story that I won't go into, but I wound up sitting down with Aaron And I didn't think, I've told her this before, I didn't think she'd be interested because her fingernails were like really, really clean. And it may have even been a French manicure, but I gave her our stories and hoped. And she gets permission to use that sonar machine that I thought you could maybe rent from Home Depot. And she actually knows how to use it. And then beyond that, the folklore at the school, all these men we talked to, many of them were like, there's another cemetery. I remember seeing it when I was a boy. There's the one on the black side, but there's also one on the white side. And so how do you search 1,400 acres for a hidden cemetery? So they brought in cadaver dogs. Some volunteers brought a big team of cadaver dogs to roam this 1,400 acre wooded property. And they hit on stuff from time to time, and they'd bring in the backhoe and dig and figure out, oh, that was a buried tree stump or some dump or what have you. But ultimately, she got approval from the cabinet to do something I honestly never thought would be done. Everybody got interested in what Aaron did with the help of Glenn and with the help of Robert. And ultimately, the DNA wound up in a lab in Texas. And we followed it out there to see what kind of things they did. And it's fascinating to learn about that process. And then ultimately they began to slowly and are still slowly identifying boys, including Glenn's uncle, Thomas Varnado. God rest his soul. Thomas got so the beauty of this for me, the bookend on this side of it, was this beautiful and touching. It was 76 years, Glenn. 76 years later, this little boy got an obituary. Finally, got an obituary and got to be placed in the ground beside his family, and that's the coolest thing for me. And we did a two-part series at the end of last year called The Lost Bones that tells the story of this incredible journey that Aaron went on from discovery to identification. And that's my part of it. Thank you.
Coming up.
The information they printed in their final report was from a niece of ours that had no knowledge or no information whatsoever about my father or my uncle going to Dozier.
More from a recent panel discussion on the Dozier School for Boys. I'm Kirsten Cooper. This is Florida Matters. I'm Kirsten Cooper. This is Florida Matters. Now, more highlights from a recent Tampa Bay History Center panel discussion on the Dozier School for Boys.
One of the boys who was taken from his family, who never came home, and who died under suspicious circumstances at Dozier was Thomas Varnado. At the time he died in 1934, Thomas was, his brother was Hubert Varnado, age 15, and Hubert is Glenn's father. Hubert and Thomas were both taken up at the same time, and Glenn is going to tell the story of how that happened. Glenn's father never talked to the children about his experience at Dozier. They grew up, though, knowing that he was obsessively fearful of authority. And they're developed inside the Dozier, the Varnado family, very close family, a collective awareness and longing for that little boy, that little 13-year-old Thomas, who never returned. I'm going to tell you a little bit about Glenn, and I'll let him tell his story. And I think the significance of Glenn's perspective is it's from the grassroots up. You have Aaron and Ben, professionals doing their work, and now you're going to hear a little bit about one specific case. Glenn lives in Lakeland with his lovely wife, Jan, who's here tonight. He's got a couple of daughters and How many grandchildren?
Four boys.
A very close family. Please welcome Glenn Varnado.
As you might imagine, this was a pretty mind-bending and heart-ripping trip for me to go down this avenue to find this member of our family. But I can tell you, without these two folks here, it would have never been possible. There were members of my family. Barbara was my sister. She passed away in 2012. When the FDLE started their investigation, they started reaching out trying to find members of the families of Dozier. Well, our family was reached out to as one of those families. So my sister responded to them, and fortunately, you know, we'd already got electronic email by that point in time, so we weren't that far back in the woods. So you can see the time date on that. So how, you know, back in December of 11 of 2008, where we were pleading with the state trying to get help. The FDLE investigators spoke with my sister. They spoke with my Uncle Richard, who was Thomas's blood brother. And the information they printed in their final report was from a niece of ours who now lives in Asheville, North Carolina, that had no knowledge or no information whatsoever about my father or my uncle going to Dozier. So there was no mention of anything my family said or that my uncle said in the FDLE investigation. And we had been searching for this kid since the late 1980s. Okay. This is where Dr. Kimmerly came to me, and Ben Montgomery came to me. Dr. Kimmerly came to me and said, "Are you aware that they're going to sell this property up in Jackson County?" And we were within 30 days of it being sold. The bids had already been put out. The bid packets were already received, and the state was about to open them. And I don't know, for whatever reason, I smelled a big rat, a rat with a tail about that long. So I made a phone call to my attorney, who was my personal attorney at the time, was a guy out of Lakeland that had been with Peterson and Myers and had since moved over to Daytona Beach. He's now the lead attorney for, most of you guys will recognize, you know, at least the company that he works for or what he does. He does all of the racetracks for NASCAR. So he lives comfortably, very comfortably in Daytona Beach, but he happened to be also a U.S. Marine. And I have a great admiration for U.S. Marines. And he said, "But I got this guy in Tampa that you ought to talk to. I'm too far away to do it. I'm going to give you this guy's name. Call him. He's a Marine. He'll get it done for you." Well, that guy's name was Bob Bolt. So I called Bob. I explained to him what the situation was. He said, he literally said, "Oh my God, I'm going to have to drop everything I've got. We're under a timeline here. We've got to get this thing moving, and it's got to move quick." And we did. We moved very quick on it. I'll give you a list of the federal and the state representatives that I sent this letter to, pleading and asking for help, telling them, you know, what we were looking for, why we were looking for, and what was going on, and that this property was about to be sold, and just basically pleading for help. I also made him aware at the time that I had retained counsel to get an exhumation order, and was I probably pretty adamant in letting people know that I had a civil right to his remains, as did his blood brother, who was still very much alive. So September of 2012, this auction was going to take place October, I believe, 14th. You'd think my phone would be ringing off the hook, but that didn't happen. So the people that really responded to me here and helped, I have to tell you, was Kelly Stargell, who was my local state representative in that regard. She was actually responsible for getting the University of South Florida about $186,000, $89,000 to keep working on the project. Senator Bill Nelson jumped on the bandwagon. He stepped in and contributed help getting a federal grant of about $464,000, and that's what kept this project alive. And I can tell you that those two folks were the prime ones. I never got a letter back from the president. That one didn't happen, and I didn't get much help from Washington on this issue, I can tell you. And then along comes Bob Bolt, and everything come to a halt. We filed a temporary restraining order asking that the state produce the remains of Thomas and that we be allowed to remove him from the school property. And that order was approved and signed by a judge, and we're able to bury Thomas with my father. Decided that his final resting place needed to be back with his brother, and he was placed there. My dad served in the Army, and I mentioned he passed in 92, and Thomas, you know, I had him buried underneath the same headstone with my father, and he remains there to this day, and we are so thankful that this story ended this way. As Ben had mentioned, you know, there was an obituary, I think it was outside in the case in the lobby as well, as if you saw that out there. But I am so thankful that we were able to recover him and able to bury him and give him the decency that anyone would deserve as a young child and as a human being. Thank you very much.
Without accountability, there is no justice. For more than a century, the culture of old Florida was permeated with tales of cruelty, death, and adolescent boys who were swept away without judicial process to Mariana. And then they disappeared, never to return to their families. No less than the governors of this state visited the reform school in Mariana, pronounced how bad things were, and then left office. This can of institutional atrocities was kicked down the road with each administration. Nothing was done about the children forgotten there. That is, nothing was done until the three individuals who appear before you appeared on the scene. The Tampa Bay History Center is proud to have had a hand in telling their story. Please join me in showing our appreciation for Glenn and Ben and Aaron.
And that's it for today's show. Special thanks go to Manny Lato and Zach Moody, the Tampa Bay History Center. This episode of Florida Matters was produced by Lottie Watts and Mark Schreiner. Florida Matters is a production of WUSF Public Media. I'm Carson Cooper. Thanks for listening.